Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, May 4th, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, presents its season finale concert May 10th at Walton Arts Center. Under the baton of Maestro Paul Haas, the concert will feature Mozart's Hofner Symphony and Mahler's Symphony No. 1 in D major. Tickets available at 443-5600 or sonamusic.org.
Ahead this morning, the founders of Olivia's Basket share the spirit of their late daughter and of the organization she inspired. And if you're planning on working in your garden today, our insect expert offers low-tech solutions to pesky insects.
Plus, our Sunday morning montage and more. But first, the Arkansas State Dental Association will hold its annual Arkansas Mission of Mercy in Springdale. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis recently spoke with one of the dentists participating in the free dental clinic, and he has this report.
Dwight Duckworth has been a dentist for 25 years. In his Springdale practice, he sees somewhere between 20 and 25 patients in a given day. But during the 8th annual Arkansas Mission of Mercy, exponentially more patients will move through the doors of the Northwest Arkansas Convention Center. The event's location rotates among five locations throughout the state each year. Dr. Duckworth is not only a dentist, but he is also the local chairman for the Springdale Mission of Mercy Clinic. He says logistics are a big concern when organizing the event.
We have to find a place to hold the event. We have to rent a whole bunch of dental chairs and dental equipment like lights and things like that, and we have to have those shipped in via trucks, and we have to coordinate the dates with graduations from high school and college and all other kinds of events so we don't get people spread too thinly.
Because the clinic's organizers expect to see about 2,200 patients during the two-day clinic, about 160 dentists and nearly 1,000 other volunteers are needed in order to make the event a success. Duckworth says that much work must be done before the first patient steps through the door on Friday, May 16th.
On Thursday, there will be forklifts unloading a lot of crates, people opening crates, setting up dental chairs, lights. We have to put plumbing inside the convention center because we have to have suction. We have to have water lines run everywhere. We have to have water, a lot of electricity. And then a number of us will be on site probably around 4:30 a.m. on Friday and Saturday to make sure that we troubleshoot everything and have everything ready to roll.
He says that while the first patients are seen at around 6 o'clock in the morning, some of those patients begin lining up outside the clinic site before 4 o'clock the previous afternoon, camping out overnight to ensure they are served early in the morning.
Once they come in, they will fill out a health questionnaire, and they will go through medical triage where we'll have nurses taking blood pressures, taking vitals, checking the patients out. We'll have at least one physician, usually two or three on site, that will go through and handle any type of medical things that might be going on, like someone who has a blood sugar that's out of control or someone who has really high blood pressure. Then once they're cleared medically, they'll go through dental triage where dentists will actually sit down and talk to them and find out what their chief complaint is. And it will be our objective to address that for them.
At that point, the dentists start working on the patient. And that work isn't just limited to filling cavities or cleaning teeth.
Our chief objective is to get people out of pain. So there will be a number of extractions. So we will remove a good number of teeth over those 2 days. We will also be doing a lot of fillings. There'll be pediatric dentists there to take care of the kiddos. And there'll be hygienists there that will be cleaning teeth. So we actually offer a pretty good array of services for doing mission work.
After a patient's treatment is complete, they will receive the necessary medication at a pharmacy station and then be released to go home. Through the entire process, a lay volunteer escorts the patient through each station in the clinic. While he and other dentists are likely missing out on potential revenue from their own private practices by taking part in the two-day clinic, Duckworth says the sacrifice is an easy one to make.
The blessings that we receive as practitioners and assistants, all the volunteers receive so much more spiritually than we give. And there are a lot of people that are out there that have been in pain for months, falls under what we do to help people. So for us to give back to the community for a couple of days, it's a very rewarding experience spiritually for us, but more importantly, it's the right thing to do.
Last year, the Mission of Mercy was held in Arkadelphia, and in other years, the free clinic is held in Jonesboro, Little Rock, or Monticello. While he admits Northwest Arkansas as a whole may be more economically advantaged than other areas of the state, Duckworth says that the greater number of people in this area means that there are still plenty of people who need dental care, but can't normally afford it. But just because the clinic is held in Northwest Arkansas doesn't mean that this area's residents are the only ones who will show up for the event.
Last time we were up here, we saw people from 5 different states. We had some people who drove up from Dallas, Texas, to have some work done. It's just a wonderful blessing that we have to be able to help take care of people.
There are no income or eligibility requirements for patients seeking treatment during the free clinic. To date, the Arkansas Mission of Mercy has seen more than 12,000 patients who have received nearly $6 million worth of dental procedures. To be able to see more than 2,000 patients in 2 days, the Arkansas Mission of Mercy has a handful of corporate partners, such as Delta Dental of Arkansas and the Walmart Foundation, but the annual clinic is also supported by an army of volunteers. When I spoke with him last week, Duckworth said that organizers were still looking for several dentists, nurses, and lay volunteers to help staff the event. To volunteer, visit ArkansasMissionOfMercy.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
In a former life at the Chamber of Commerce, they used to say once in a while, this is a big deal. Today, Gary, this is a big deal.
Thursday morning, several dozen people gathered inside the Jones Center in Springdale, where Ed Clifford, president and CEO, announced big news for the center. The George family has pledged $1 million to the Jones Center Endowment Fund. The gift is helping the center get closer to its goal of raising $30 million for an endowment. Members of the George family attended Thursday morning's announcement, including Gary George, chairman of George's Incorporated, a Springdale-based poultry company. George says his family has a long history with Harvey Jones and his wife, Bernice, the founder of the Jones Center.
My father and my uncle and the families, it's a relationship that goes well beyond my years. And I just knew of what they've done over the years for this area, and it was just the right thing to do.
Ed Clifford, president and CEO of the Jones Center, says it meant a lot to receive this gift from the George family.
There are pillars of the community in all the cities of the corridor, but the George family is one of those families that is absolutely right up there at the top. Their contributions to Northwest Arkansas have been significant. But their friendships with each of those other families is what sort of makes Northwest Arkansas special. And the George family and Harvey and Bernice Jones were close, really close, as Gary said. And so it meant a great deal to him to have their family be able to help our endowment campaign for something that's named after Harvey and Bernice Jones. So.
Clifford says in 2012, the expanded board of directors conducted a careful analysis of the Jones Center programs, operations, and staffing, and approved a new strategic plan that would bring the center to a sustainable level that would allow it to continue serving the community for years to come. According to a news release, the expanded Jones Trust Board approved a stringent spending policy, limiting the organization to a 3.5% draw to ensure finances remained strong for years.
When the new board, and I was part of the board, then took over, we realized that with the amount of spending they were doing at the Jones Center, that they only had about 4 or 5 more years left in the endowment fund. And so we made some significant changes. We made significant changes in our operating procedures, in the programming that we had, and then in the staffing that we had, and took the budget here from $5.6 million to $3.6 million a year. And then we decided that, in fact, we would need about $50 million to help sustain that expenditure, And so we were $30 million short of the $50 million.
In December of 2012, the Jones Trust launched an endowment campaign with the announcement of $20 million in contributions from the Walton Family Foundation and CARE Foundation. According to a news release, CARE Foundation contributed a gift of $10 million, while the Walton Family Foundation made available up to $10 million, pending the realization of a 1-2 match requiring an additional $10 million to be raised from additional supporters. Clifford says including announcements that will be made in the coming months regarding additional gifts, they have $2.5 million left to raise. Clifford says the money will help keep prices at the Jones Center low, and it will help put a very positive spin on each staff member's ability to do his or her job.
They don't have to say, well, can I afford to do this? They can try to do it. If it doesn't work, we don't have to do it again. But if it does work, it's something that really made sense. And this gives us the ability to try almost anything we want to try in the center, and that's really important. Really important for the staff, really important for the community.
More information is available at thejonescenter.net.
As Northwest Arkansas has grown, so has the variety of nonprofits operating in the region. Olivia's Basket is unique. In the past 5 years, the Northwest Arkansas-based organization has built 9 new homes in 3 locations, in Mexico and Honduras. They work with Homes of Hope to identify locations and families meeting qualifications. And then, with under $8,000 and about 15 people over the age of 15 in 2 days, weather permitting, build a new home. Tuesday, Olivia's Basket will have its first ever public fundraiser. Eat, Build, Love, at the Garden Room on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently talked to the creators of Olivia's Basket, Jane and John Ray, about Olivia's Basket. Jane Ray explained the organization's namesake is their daughter, Olivia, who lost her life more than 4 years ago.
I describe Olivia as the best of all of us. She was outgoing, intensely creative, and she was the kid on the playground that if she saw someone not playing with anybody, she would go over to them and play with them. And in light of that, to create an organization that simply helps other people is kind of perfect.
It's interesting to respond to grief. I mean, because we've been in the ministry for a long time, so we've walked with other people through this. And oftentimes there is an intense desire to try to create something to hold on to the memory of a person. We were really fortunate and really blessed that it was stuff we were already doing. You know, I had been on a house build that summer with Olivia. She jumped up there and, you know, grabbed a paintbrush and painted a little bit and then would play with a dog or play with a kid and run around and help hand stuff up. So it was stuff that we were already doing. It was stuff that already expressed where Olivia was and what she was involved with. So this, there was such a tremendous outpouring of grief and support from the Fayetteville, Northwest Arkansas community that we already had this avenue there. We just kind of created the project of Olivia's Basket around that to capture that.
A little bit under $8,000, about a dozen to maybe 15 people, 2 to 3 days.
Right.
Yes. Let's say we start at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, and hopefully by 4 o'clock the next afternoon, we're handing those keys over.
And it's if the weather holds.
If the weather holds, good point on that. And there's not a system at the end of this build, but just to slightly describe it, it's this. The keys are given to the family. They're the first people to enter their own home alone. Then, maybe, 10 minutes after that, we knock on the door or somebody, and then they open the door, and we're the very first guests that they have. And it's a cheer. Everyone is happy and laughing. And I know that there's a TV show where they say, move that bus, but this is bigger. Yeah. Every single person is affected, and the neighborhoods involved as well. It's a remarkable thing to experience.
You have stories on at oliviasbasket.org about the people who have moved in and what it has meant and what it can mean for a family that's struggling. And now they have shelter.
Right.
And so much, it's exponential what can happen after that, instead of struggling just to find out where you're going to live.
Well, the statistics are overwhelming when you consider, just take health for an issue. You cut the chance and incidence of disease and sickness over 50% merely by moving someone off the dirt onto a concrete slab. So you've increased their health by half overnight with that. The ability to think generationally. When a family is living in a tent or a hovel or something that can't be locked up, can't be guarded, someone has to stay with their possessions. That prevents a family member from going to school or from working. Day-to-day existence limits your ability to invest in the future nutritionally in your family, educationally in your family, socially in your family. By providing a house, you are, in a way, literally providing a way for them to now start thinking about the future that they did not have before they had it.
At the Garden Room, there is a benefit.
It's the first benefit we've ever had. We reached a point last year where we approached our family, our kids, and we said, okay, are we going to keep doing this? And without hesitation, every one of our daughters said, absolutely, we really, really want to continue to do this. And that's when we said, it's time. It's time to blow it out and make it bigger.
Yeah, because up to this point, the generosity of Northwest Arkansas and the way that they have carried us, the churches, the friends, the Leverett PTO has been unbelievable. And we really haven't had to ask for a lot of help financially. But we understood, you know, things change. It's been 5 years and coming up this fall. And so we knew that we needed to raise some funds, but we also wanted to do something so out of the ordinary. We wanted to do something very different than just put on a fundraiser. And Jane will probably speak to that, what our vision is for that.
This is personal to us. So when we approached this, it needed to be who we were, who we are, essentially. We wanted it to be, again, personal, intimate, and extraordinary. And the way that we knew to do this was to make it around some really good food, which creates really good conversation, which creates an atmosphere where when you leave, you feel invigorated and honored and willing to say, I want to do more. That is the entire hope of the evening, just so that people leave going, this is an extraordinary thing.
Well, you have a special chef.
Yes, we do.
I feel this is a personal acquaintance as well.
Well, so oftentimes, look, we go there because there is a tremendous level of poverty. That's where we're building houses. But we're not going down there just because there's a problem that needs to be fixed. Our heart, to a large degree, is in this area. It's an incredible culture. It's a rich environment. And the history, the food, the people there, we consider some of our closest friends. And Ismine, we met her through a mutual friend. And Jane will tell you, when anyone comes up and starts talking about food and they place their hand on their heart while they're speaking of the food, we're won over. And so we got to be friends with her, and I wish she was here to tell the story. We became friends, and then she lost her father and went through a very difficult time. And through hearing our story and knowing what we had been through with losing Olivia, we really connected. We really bonded. And it's one of those just incredible, special relationships. She's one of the top chefs in Baja. She's working in the Valle de Guadalupe, which is just an area that is exploding with the food and wine scene down there. And she's one of the recognized leaders in that scene there. And so for her to close her restaurant, which is on her mom's vineyard, and to come here to Fayetteville for a week is a significant sacrifice on her behalf. I mean, it's... when we came up with the idea and then she said yes without hesitation, honestly, we were We were a little bit taken aback. It was something that, wow, she would really do that for us. So we can't wait for her to get here and think that it's just having her in our home and taking her out to meet friends and do things is special enough.
Do you know what the menu is going to be?
No.
Because she's going to be using locally sourced food, right?
And honestly, for us, that is a thrilling thing. We have consistently reached out to the different vendors in the farmers market, from meats and poultry, everything, have sent her that information so she can start to possibly gather something together. There's also a contact with the four James Beard nominated chefs in Bentonville, and they too have enlisted, saying this is who we use, etc. And she's hoping, we're hoping that she can just sync up and meet them when she gets here.
John and Jane Ray are the creators of the nonprofit organization Olivia's Basket. The fundraiser Eat, Build, Love is Tuesday night at the Garden Room in Fayetteville. Tickets are limited to 100 seats. For more information about the fundraiser, eatbuildlove.com, and you can learn more about Olivia's Basket at oliviasbasket.org. The Rays talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this week.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Do you have high hopes for your garden this year? Many people are in the process of planting for summer harvest, or maybe harvesting things like lettuce or kale already. Just as people do, insects like plants, and often the plants we plant are especially succulent or sweet. I invited Dr. Donald Steinkraus, our Ozarks at Large's insect expert, into the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss ways to deter bugs from eating our summer veggies before we do. According to Dr. Steinkraus, there is an insect for every plant.
If you grow squash, you're going to have squash bugs in this area, and that's one of our main problems, squash bugs. Have you ever grown squash?
I have not, but yeah. I know I see it all. I mean, you know, I see a lot of it at the farmer's market.
Yeah, there's a lot of different kinds. We had one variety of squash we really wanted to grow. It's called Hokkaido squash. I guess it's Japanese. And just sounded great from all the ads, sweet and delicious and nutritious and everything. But we've tried many years to grow that one. And every year the squash bugs have killed that variety for us. So we're no longer going to try to grow Hokkaido. And instead, we've been growing this squash called Delicata. And it seems a little bit more resistant. At least we get some plants, fruit from it, which is a Hokkaido. They just killed the plants every year.
So there's really no way to deter the squash bugs from getting to that particular...
Well, there are, and we're working on it. Like, one of the things, as an entomologist, I like to do is always go low-tech first. And in a small garden... A lot of things you can just hand pick them and squash them and, you know, destroy them by hand because you don't have a lot of plants. And that's generally the route we've gone with squash bugs is we search the plants and pull the leaves up, and when we see a bug, we squish it. And when we see the egg masses, we squash them and the nymphs. The problem becomes that unless you do it every day, they just keep coming and... So there's other methods you can use to control them. They're a hemipteran, you know, that has a piercing, sucking mouth part that they stick into the plant and suck the plant juice out with. You never seen a squash bug before?
I don't know.
They're about an inch long. The adults are kind of gray. Yeah. And when you squash them, all of these bugs have a scent gland in them. When you squash them, it makes a funny smell. I just squash them by hand or against a rock.
It's like a stink bug.
Sort of like a stink bug. Yeah, a lot of them have glands which are defensive, so birds won't eat them. Other things, toads might not eat them.
Do they have a, you know, a squash bug? That's not their scientific name.
Yeah, the scientific name is Anassa tristis, and they're a coreid or leaf-footed bug. There's a lot of different insects out there, and... this one is just particularly intractable. I'd say of the insects in our garden, that's our number one problem.
Is there anything you can do to control them?
There's a thing called floating row covers, which are a very light fabric that's not woven. You can buy it in rolls, and you can put it over your plants and just floats on top of them. It doesn't squash them down, and you can sort of weight it down around the edge, and that keeps any bugs from coming to the plant and getting on it because they hit this little covering. But light and air and water can still get through it. And that's one method people use to control squash bugs is put that over the young plants. But you have to remove that excluding cover when the plants bloom in order that they can get pollinated so the pollinators can get in there. You can use insecticides to control them, but I'm trying to avoid using insecticides in my home garden.
I think most people are these days, yeah.
Yeah, you sometimes have to, but I'm really trying. I just don't want to have so many chemicals in my diet.
Well, I know a lot of people like to have homegrown tomato. Mm-hmm. You can just walk out to your garden and grab one and take a big bite out of it.
Right. They're good.
Sometimes you'll pick a tomato and you can see that something has maybe burrowed a hole or something into one, maybe.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of things that do that. One is there's a thing called the tomato fruit worm, which is also the cotton boll worm, and it's Helicoverpizea. It's a noctuid moth, and the larva, the caterpillar, really likes fruit. So in cotton, it bores into the boll and chews a hole in it and wrecks it for cotton production. That's a very serious pest in a lot of crops. And in the tomatoes, it will also do the same thing. It'll chew its way into the fruit and eat it. And, of course, the other one that a lot of people notice around here is the tomato hornworm or the tobacco hornworm, a great big, large sphingid moth. And people call them hummingbird moths or hornworm moths. And these are big caterpillars, get to be like 3-4 inches long. And they will also chew into green fruits and eat the developing fruit because that's the most rich structure on the plant.
I don't blame them.
No. And actually, a few of them are not that bad. One principle of like integrated pest management, which is a good concept, is that you aren't out to get 100% kill of the pests or the weeds or anything. You know, your goal is not absolute destruction of every last individual. And you tolerate some damage. Like that gets back to that low-tech idea I have is that search your plants, look for damage on the plant. So when I look at my tomatoes, I always look to see, have leaves been eaten? And you can look for the frass or the droppings from the caterpillar on the ground underneath.
We started the conversation by saying that gardening really is time-consuming.
It is.
And yeah, if you want to, yeah, it's really getting out there every day. And check
well,
it for
ideally,
stuff.
Probably yeah. A person would every day
yeah.
is check it for a little while and work on it a bit, watch over things. Actually, a good insecticide for both tomato hornworm and the tomato fruit worm would be a Bacillus thuringiensis, BT. Now, BT is one of the organisms I used to work on in my research. It's a soil microbe, a bacterium that produces a toxin. And when a caterpillar eats that toxin, it destroys their gut, and then bacteria get into their bloodstream, and they die within about 24 hours. And it's considered an organic material when used as a spray, and it's totally harmless to us when used as a spray on the plants.
So, but this isn't something you can just go to Lowe's and get.
Oh, yes, it can.
You
yes.
can.
Yeah, you can buy. There's a lot of insecticides you can buy at Lowe's or at Southern Farm Cooperative or any of the sort of tractor supply companies and farm supply companies. I think that, in my opinion, that insecticide should be your last choice.
I love having tomatoes in the summertime. What is your one thing that you make sure you plant in your garden every year? What is your favorite vegetable
so many,
or fruit?
I can't really say because we like them all. Like right now we're harvesting asparagus, which does extremely well here. And asparagus is a perennial and gets better year after year. We planted it about 4 years ago. Now we're harvesting quite a bit of asparagus. It also seems to be relatively pest-free. So that's a very early, delicious vegetable, and there's nothing like asparagus picked that day from your garden.
Oh, it is good. I never realized until recently that it grows just one stalk at a time, just sticking straight up.
Yeah. They are a great plant. If you have a garden, you're going to be there for a while. Because they can last for 20 years, and you can keep harvesting. So that's our first thing right now, but we love okra. And I haven't had any trouble with pests on it. No insects have bothered us on that. So that way you don't have to worry about it quite so much.
Anything else we have to hit?
Well, you know, there's just so many different types of gardens.
And everybody, as we were talking about our favorites, other, you know, people have their favorites, things that they like to grow. So.
Yeah. I think to have a healthy garden, you want to try to make like a small ecosystem. It's worth planting flowers, like zinnias are really good plants here. I think zinnias are just fantastic cutting plants and very attractive in the garden.
I have some right now.
Do you?
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, they're nice. And they attract the butterflies, which is nice to watch the butterflies. I love going out in the garden seeing butterflies in there while I'm working. They attract bees. But they also attract beneficial insects, too, which will sip their nectar. So the parasitic wasps will come and get nectar from the the flowers. And then they'll be there to lay their eggs in some of the pests. So trying to have a little ecosystem is really a good thing to do, I think.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Steinkraus.
Oh, you're welcome. And good gardening to you.
Dr. Donald Steinkraus is an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
LOL.
What happens?
Let's do...
when technology starts to change our language.
Lol, let's do this interview via text. Lol.
It would take us like forever to do this by text.
Oh, lol.
I'm Guy Raz. Spoken and unspoken, stories from the frontiers of human communication. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Listen this Sunday at noon to 91.3 FM.
Good morning. It is May 4th, 2014, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is the Kevin Kinder moment where the music editor of Northwest Arkansas Newspapers is going to talk through my mouth.
Okay.
About a band called St. Paul and the Broken Bones.
I don't know them.
I have heard good things about them.
He says wonderful things about them. They're from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, which, did I know, it's produced a bunch of great bands. Who knew? This band is good enough that on their most recent tour, they're 78 gigs into 117 days.
Oh, wow.
He talked to Browen Lawler, who was in Santa Fe, New Mexico at the time, and he was part of the 400 unit, which was the backing band for Jason Isbell, who's a former member of the Drive-By Truckers, which is another Muscle Shoals area band.
Okay.
And Brokaw started his own band called St. Paul and the Broken Bones. Kevin did not ask him why, but their lead singer is a former pastor in training who is apparently an amazing, well, the Austin Chronicle said that this gentleman, whose name is Paul Janeway, looks like Drew Carey and sings like Otis Redding.
How funny.
So it should be a great concert. It's 9 o'clock tonight at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville, and tickets are $10. Also this afternoon, for a slightly older crowd perhaps, Hal Linden is in concert.
Yes, in Bentonville.
As part of the Live on Stage in Northwest Arkansas series, that starts at 2 o'clock at Arend Art Center, and tickets are $25 for adults.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
While sitting on a patio at one of the many restaurants located near Dixon Street in Fayetteville, it's not unusual to hear the sound of a train passing by. The Arkansas and Missouri Railroad runs through much of Northwest Arkansas, and earlier this year, Railway Age magazine named the A&M Railroad Company the 2014 Regional Railroad of the Year. The award was presented at the American Short Line and Regional Association's annual meeting, which occurred last week in San Diego. Riley McCarron, chairman of the A&M, was on hand to receive the award last week.
It is extremely gratifying to be recognized in that way. It's a little humbling, too, to be honest, because there are 500 and some odd short line regional railroads in the United States. You know, but our folks have worked very hard for what will be, well, it's already 27 years, it'll be 28 years on Labor Day, you know, to build the A&M into what it is today. And, you know, for them to earn that recognition is really wonderful.
The A&M was established in 1986 as a Class 3 railroad that operates from Monett, Missouri to Fort Smith, Arkansas, and its corporate headquarters are located in Springdale. The main line includes about 140 miles of track, and McCarran says there are about 10 miles of branch lines. According to an article by Railway Age magazine, the Springdale-based railroad company has upgraded its mainline trackage and clearances to allow for higher speeds and double-stack container trains, while modernizing its locomotive fleet and locomotive shop. McCarran says last year they bought 3 new locomotives, and this is just one of a number of projects the A&M has completed or is working on.
Our sister company built a Ozark Transmodal, built a 60,000-foot warehouse extension in Fort Smith last year. This year we're working together with one of our customers to up in Butterfield, Missouri, to build a terminal that will handle both grain and also construction sand. We'll move some of that activity up there to be a little closer to our customers.
The A&M provides freight service and interchanges traffic with 3 Class 1 railroads, Burlington Northern Santa Fe, Kansas City Southern, and the Union Pacific, as well as the Fort Smith Railroad. According to the A&M's website, all lines are rated at 286,000 pounds and cleared for double-stack rail cars, and main lines feature continuous welded rail. Track Superintendent Larry Rouse has more than 4 decades of experience in the railroad industry, and he is one of the people who helps make sure things run smoothly for the A&M.
I come from a railroad family. Parents had worked on the railroad. My grandfathers had worked on the railroad. And I guess it's part, they say it's in your blood.
Because of the constant use, parts of the rail, of course, need to be replaced from time to time. Because of the curves and hills in the area, Larry says the rails have a tendency to wear out sooner than he would like, but he says you just have to get into a routine of replacing the rail every so often.
It depends on your tonnage that runs over and the curves, the degree of curves. You're probably looking at, if you get a 10 to 15 years of some lifespan of some rail. You know, today, you know, years ago, they was just regular steel. Now they have a head-hardened steel where it's hardened. You know, technology has come a long way since I first started. I mean, it changes almost daily. You know, things, it's like the everything else in the country. So you got to keep up or you get lost.
In addition to delivering freight, the A&M also operates passenger train excursions. Larry's wife, Brenda, is the operations manager for the passenger train, and she has been with the railroad for 14 years. She says when she first started, the excursion train ran 6 months out of the year and carried about 6,800 passengers. They now operate year-round, and last year, she says they transported 40,000 riders. Much like other parts of the A&M's operations, the excursion train is also undergoing some changes.
Over the last year, we've just acquired a new Vista Dome, which was part of the California Zephyr train. And 2 weeks ago, we just got another new car in, which was part of the Spirit of Texas, the Sunset Special. And it is a dining car, and we're in the process of getting it remodeled and getting it ready to put on the rails.
Brenda says they have 7 train cars now. Regular excursions include trips from Springdale to Van Buren and from Van Buren to Winslow. During the winter, the railroad often has special holiday trains as well. Brenda says this fall, they will introduce some Razorback train excursions. She says they have worked out some dates with the city of Rogers to run a train from Rogers to Baum Stadium in Fayetteville for a few of the November football games. She says this will be the first year for this trip, but they have been talking about it for years, and it's the extra equipment they have that is allowing them to finally organize the trips this fall. Brenda says they are always looking for something different to add to their offerings.
People are looking for different venues and things like that. You know, when I first started, we did a lot of leisure group travel, and we do a lot of group tours, but now we're kind of tapping into the corporate market to where you can also have training on the train, group meetings. We've done a lot of weddings, birthday parties. We've had a couple shotgun weddings, surprise shotgun weddings over the mountain. Just always looking for something different to add.
Another new event for the A&M is hosting the National Railway Historical Society's annual convention June 10th through the 15th. Brenda says this is the first time Arkansas has hosted the event. June 14th through the 15th, Amtrak's historic exhibit train will be in Springdale for a free display featuring a specially painted locomotive to commemorate America's veterans, as well as displays showcasing the history of the nation's intercity passenger railroad. Information on the convention is available at nrhs.com. For more on the Arkansas-Missouri Railroad, visit amrailroad.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
They are some of the most compelling and challenging pages of all 20th century organ music, created by a virtuoso for his own concerts, but also for use in church and for teaching, too. Jeremy Filsell performs music of Marcel Dupré in a Dupré collection, this week on Pipe Dreams from American Public Media. I'm Michael Barone. I hope you'll be listening.
Listen to Pipe Dreams tonight at 9 on KUAF.
Well, so Antoinette, we just heard your story about the Arkansas-Missouri Railroad. Mm-hmm. I know that's a story that you'd been wanting to do for a little while.
Yes, I've been sort of wanting to have a reason to go to the A&M Depot in Springdale, kind of talk to them about what they do. So I was glad to, I'm of course pleased as punch that they got this award and very glad to have the opportunity to go check out a little bit more of what happens at the depot.
Right. Well, I decided to use the railroad and trains for the subject of our Sunday morning montage.
I like it.
There are so many movies and TV shows and songs that have trains in them.
Trains are very important.
They really are. I mean, and they have been for a long time.
Yes.
Well, so it was so hard to narrow down it down to 11 clips, but I tried. So here they are.
All aboard!
Well, you coming?
Where?
Why, to the North Pole, of course! This is the Polar Express!
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around the bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when.
He's a cheeky little engine with six small wheels, a short, stumpy funnel, a short, stumpy boiler, and a short, stumpy dome.
Tackle my back, died of transportation in the back of a hack. I deserve the rhythm of the clickety-clack, and hear the whistle blowing, see the smoke from the stack. Fell around with Democrat fellas named Mac. Take me right back to the track, Jack. Choo-choo, choo-choo, chibogie, woo-woo.
Nee, tala ni svenska.
Alas, mademoiselle, that is the extent of my Swedish. Forgive me if I am personal, but most Scandinavians of my acquaintance are well educated in other languages. And yet you have difficulty.
I was born backwards.
Look at the hoverboard!
but after all is said and done, you did get me home, and I really appreciate
it. Hey, next time, let's go first class, all right?
God, I hope there isn't a next time.
I know what you mean. I really do. This you?
You did on this week's montage, go to ozarksatlarge.com.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Wendy LaFay, Ron Landis, and Richard Burnett are the Sweetwater Gypsies. Earlier this week, they stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio for a conversation and a few songs, including this one.
Here's a song about every time you leave Arkansas and you go somewhere, you always remember how good Arkansas is when you come back. So here's a place called Another Place Like Home.
The Sweetwater Gypsies will play at the New Delhi Cafe in Eureka Springs, Friday, May 16th, from 6:30 to 10:30 p.m. For more information, Sweetwater Gypsies on Facebook.
KUAF is supported by Aurora Digital Signage, where images and videos can be instantly uploaded and displayed on multiple screens and locations, leading to improved communication in hotels, museums, restaurants, retail environments, and school systems. AuroraDigitalSignage.com for more information.
A listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Westville, Oklahoma. Just on the border.
Just on the border right there.
Right. I think we're kind of sticking with a train theme this morning.
We are.
But you did your railroad story earlier in the show. And I know when I go out and interview people that there's a lot of stuff that doesn't get into the story mm-hmm. because we have so much audio. It's hard to pare it down.
It is. So I just wanted to have one more thing that I learned while doing the story. What sort of initially inspired me to ask questions about the railroad was earlier this year, following one of those winter storms that we got, the snow had kind of cleared out. But driving to work one day, I pulled up to a stop sign or a stoplight on Greg in Fayetteville, and I looked over and there were two or three guys knelt. They were kneeling down over the railroad, and it was like on fire. And I couldn't for the life of me figure out why they were doing this. I thought maybe it had something to do with melting ice, but I'd never seen this before, and it was just seemed like this very novel thing. So when I went to the depot, I spoke with Larry Rouse, the track superintendent, and I asked him what could I have been seeing.
Oh, that may be a case where we call it ribbon rail, continuous welded rail, where if it's joined at a it may have separated, pulled apart, as we call them, pull apart. So what they do is you take a rope, not a, you know, a rope as you see in a hardware store, but it's soaked in a chemical where you light it on fire, or light it, and it'll burn and heat the rail back up to that point where it was prior to the pull apart, and put it back together, repair it. So there's a lot of things, you know, you see that you take for granted. So if you see, you know, like yourself, you know, it's something different. Where for myself, I've been doing this for years. It's just a common thing. So.
And that was Larry Rouse, the track superintendent for the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad, explaining some of the things that they do involving fire on the railroad, just to satisfy my own curiosity. So hopefully you learned something new, too.
I did.
Okay.
For sure. All right. Well, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And sort of keeping with that train theme, I thought I'd include one of my favorite songs that didn't make it into my Sunday morning montage. But this is Midnight Train to Georgia by Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Too much for the man.
Too much for the man. He couldn't make it.
So he's leaving the life he's come to know. Ooh.
He said he's going.
He said he's going back to find.
Going back to find.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. What's left of his world. The world he left behind not so long ago. He's leaving,
leaving
on that midnight train to Georgia.
Leaving on the midnight train.
Yeah, said he's going.